Yeah, thanks for suffering through me one more time. I guarantee Lisa would have been a better presenter, but but here it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, well. Okay, so now we're moving on to the microbiology part of stable fly development. So here's the previous slide, just as a point of reference again. In terms of the ecology of stable fly larvae, we're looking at the ecosystem's ecology part. So food webs, energy transformations, and nutrient transfers. Just a slide again to remind us why we're here, and that stable fly larvae develop in very different kinds of environments, and we want to know why, what's going on. From the previous presentation, it doesn't look like we've identified the physiochemical parameters associated with that. Maybe there's microbial communities. So what's the common denominator? And again, this is just another slide of just kind of driving home the point that in common larval developmental sites, it's pretty usual to dig here, find stable fly larvae, dig here, find larvae, but they're not here, they're not here. They may be present even as a whole in this unit, and then maybe not in the next one or the one across the way. And why is that? I mean, it looks the same, smells the same. We don't know what the difference is. And so we had an opportunity to do some 4x4 sequencing, and we decided to look at some of these questions. So the setup, basically, we did essentially three different setups, and this is with an N of one, okay? So all the results I'm gonna show you have to be interpreted with caution, but you know, it's what we had to work with. We're really gonna use it as like a platform for further studies, but we did find some really interesting results, and I'll talk about that when we get to it. So for the first part of this, we essentially collected a substrate from the calf pens. We let it sit out for a couple of weeks and let whatever was emerging in it or already present in it emerge. So it kind of aged a little bit more in the lab. And then we inoculated it with stable fly eggs from the colony. And then when the stable flies were third instar, we took the third instars. And then we also took some lab substrate without the third instars, and we extracted the DNA from both of these, the 16S and 18S. Okay, the second part of this experiment was we actually went out into the field, or that's what this was actually, sorry. Over here, this we actually have common lab media that's pretty simple. It's composed of vermiculite, fish meal, wheat bran, and water, and that's essentially it. It's a very kind of reduced environment compared to obviously what you find in the environment, but it works well for growing stable flies. And so we took the lab media because we wanted to compare the microbial community in the lab media with what's naturally occurring outside. So we did something similar in that we took the lab media, we let it age for 2 weeks to sort of be able to compare it with this study. We inoculated it with our colony, waited till they were third instars, pulled out the third instars and the substrate, extracted the DNA from that. And then we went out into the field because we wanted to know, without letting it age, you know, what was going on naturally. So we found some of the substrate that had larvae in it. We took the larvae out, and then we took some of this, what we're calling positive substrate. We extracted the DNA from both of those. And then we went into a section where there were no larvae. So this is like, for instance, in the same calf pen, where you see a clump of larvae here and no larvae here. Well, why is that? It's not based on something that we're able to detect. Could it be the microbial community, right? We know that this is not a homogeneous substrate. So what's going on there? And then this is kind of interesting here. We also wanted to compare that with sort of a sterile third instar. So we had third instar larvae that were growing on is a combination of nutrient auger and egg yolk media. We surface sterilized the eggs. We didn't see anything growing on the media. We assumed it was a clean larva, and we had found like this magic bullet, you know, media that they don't need bacteria to develop. It turns out that that wasn't the case. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But at the time, we considered that the clean larva that was coming off the third instar. And so these were already included in the analyses that I'm going to show you. There wasn't enough time to take that out. But we're not going to talk about that unless you really want to. And if you do, then you can purchase afterwards. So the first question is the microbial community of the larva a reflection of the bacteria in the substrate, which is really what we're looking at. And so these are color-coded. So again, this is 4x4 sequencing. This is just a 16S. And so the way that this is presented here and in the following slides is these are kind of color-coded by experiment. So when we took the substrate from the field, brought it into the lab, let it age a while, and then inoculated it. Those are in green. You have the larva and then the food. The natural lab media is in blue, the food and then the larva. And then these are kind of orangish when we went out into the field and just collected the substrate with and without larvae and then the larvae. And then this guy's off to the side. Okay, and so phylum level assignments for the sequences from the larvae and the substrate. The major players were the proteobacteria, Bacteroidetes, Firmicutes, and Actinobacteria. One of the things that we noticed is that for the Bacteroidetes, that there appeared to be a reduction in the larva versus in the food source. And again, I want to remind you that this is an N of 1. You know, this is kind of interesting because you see this consistent relationship between the larva and the food source that it was extracted from, which is interesting because we only had one sample, really you would have expected such a tremendous amount of variation that maybe you wouldn't detect the differences. So the fact that we see consistent differences is really interesting. And it kind of supports some of what Dana was talking about earlier as well. Okay, so we pull out the Bacteroidetes, and this is with the number of assignments. We find that the Bacteroidetes are reduced in the larvae compared to the substrate. So this might be an interesting avenue to look into, is possibly maybe a potential food source that they're using that's being digested as it passes through the digestive system. Possibly they could be avoiding it, I don't know. We know that they interact with their environment now. There might be, for instance, volatile organic compounds of this class, a bacteria might be excreting that maybe they're repelled by. So there's a couple of possibilities here. When we looked at the proteobacteria only, we found that the gamma proteobacteria are actually enriched in the larvae or higher in the larvae compared to the substrate. And that was mainly due to the xanthomondalis order. When we looked at the firmicutes only, again, we see some consistent trends in that is mostly the erysipelagrecia, which are enriched in the larvae compared to the substrate. And I believe this is a potential pathogen, is that right? So it's kind of interesting. All right, when we looked at the actinobacteria and the stablefly larvae, we found, oopsies, that they are also enriched in the larvae compared to the substrate. So again, the point here is that we are seeing some trends that appear to be consistent between the larvae and the sample, at least when we look at it at this level. You know, things get kind of messy when you come down to the species level, but I think that there's always been kind of this discussion that if you're going to find differences, it's probably really going to be in the functional groups of bacteria. And so there's real strength in looking at this from this level. And obviously we need to repeat this and examine this a little more in depth. I really like this slide, so this is just sort of a bird's eye view when you combine all of the larvae and the major players involved there with the substrate. You see some very different microbial communities here. Okay, so answering the question of whether or not the microbial community of the larvae, is it really a reflection of the bacteria in the substrate? The answer appears to be no. Next question. Are there any significant taxa that are present or absent in the field substrate that contained larvae versus field substrate that had no larvae? So does the microbial community explain the difference between larval absence and presence or patches of larvae in these communities? And the answer is no. We need to do a PCA, well, according to this anyway, again, this is a sample of one, so maybe, you know, we just need to go in and measure the variation between the two. But when you do a PCA on this, it's really interesting that all of the flies basically group here together. But the two substrates that were positive and negative, they group very tightly too. And it is interesting to see that that's a little different from the field food, which was allowed to age for a little while. So there is, as I think Ludwig Zurich presented on that information, there is a change in the microbial community somewhat as the substrate ages. Okay, so another question that I really wanted to answer is, what types of fungi are present in the larvae and substrates? And this comes from actually dissecting the gut of the larvae, which is kind of, again, it's a simple method, but I'm a simple person. You know, I want to look inside and see what's inside it. And when you do that, you actually see a lot of fungi. You see a lot of yeast that are inside the larval gut. And I think that this is really an aspect of this that's being largely ignored and not talked about. It's kind of complicated though. I mean, you can't do everything. It's something that's worth talking about. So when we did the 4-5-4 sequencing, I wanted to look at that. That was done though primarily with 18S, universal 18S primers, which as you know don't only cover fungi. So we did have some fungi that were represented here. I just switched over to a slide that kind of talks more about the common name, the green and blue molds, yeast, an amoeba parasite is obviously not a fungi. But we also had this huge section up here that looked at the Aviolata, which is getting into the next question of what other eukaryotes were present in the larvae of the substrate. So focusing in on this part up here, that included the Apicomplexa, ciliates, dinoflagellates. And when we break that out a little more, we got some interesting results. Looks like it picked up some Cryptosporidia, Coccidia, Apicomplexa, and some other stuff too. But again, you know, these were not specific primers for this group. And so this interpretation for this really needs to be taken with caution. I think really what we could say is that there are other eukaryotes that are involved here. But again, I'm a simple person. I like to do dissections with larvae taken straight from the environment. So I happen to have these micrographs from light dissections. And we actually did see some apicomplexans that were from, here's from the gut of the third instar larva. You can see these sort of comma-shaped organisms. That may not look too impressive. Here's an up-close view as best as we could get it using confocal microscopy. And this looks a lot like a Gregorin, even though it's super small. This is about 10 micrometers long. You can see the sort of the burrowing end of things right here, and then here's the nucleus. Okay, another light microscope. So these are the Malpighian tubules, and you can see them kind of just bursting out of that by accident. Here's an up-close picture of that. So, I mean, when we find them in the larva, it's not like we find one or two. They're, like, heavily infested with these things. We also did some SVM micrographs looking at the exterior of the amygdala, and we happen to find these guys, which look a lot like Gregorins. What they're doing on the exterior of the amygdala, I don't know. And these are quite a bit larger. So whether or not they're the same organism, I don't know. How much time do I have left? Okay, I can do this. All right, so I was kind of just briefly talking about some of the other organisms outside of bacteria that we found associated with the stable fly larvae. But going back to the bacteria and just sort of tie this in with functional groups, in the morphology of the stable fly larva, is we wanted to look at larval responses to volatile organic compounds. And this is based on the fact that we did identify certain functional groups of microorganisms that seem to be recurring with larval development, and they do have an antennae, right? So they can smell. So we wanted to know what the response would be of these larvae to volatile organic compounds. So the idea being that in their environment, are there groups, functional groups of microorganisms that are releasing volatile compounds that are sort of an attractant for larval development or larval grazing. So the objective here is to characterize responses of larvae to these compounds. So the method is really simple but really time consuming, and this closely follows a protocol that was laid out for Karana and Siddiqui at Cold Spring Harbor, looking at Drosophila larvae. Essentially what this is it's an auger, it's a 1% agarose plate. You put 15 third instar larvae in the middle, and you load 20 microliters of a compound that you want to look at here and here. In this initial protocol, we had water here and here to serve as a negative control. Basically, you put the lid on it, you wait 2 minutes, and then you count the number of the larvae that are in these odor zones. So if they're in this like half moon shape, then that counts as a positive. So we did this for each compound. We did tenfold dilutions up to 10 to the negative 5. Each dilution was tested with a new group of larvae, and the whole thing was repeated 3 times for each compound for 3 biological replicates. So we had quite an initial list. And I'm not going to get into the rationale behind this, but it was based off of a literature review of going into the substrates that we commonly find stable fly larvae in and identifying the volatiles that are coming off of that substrate. That's what this was based off of. And then ammonia, which I don't have time to talk about. But it turns out ammonia was our big winner. So when we put stable fly larvae in the middle here, very shortly, within definitely 2 minutes, at least on these agarose plates, the stable fly larvae couldn't get enough of the ammonia. They like went crazy for it. And this is at full concentration, right? So like where our eyes would probably be watering, they were going nuts over it. And they would stay there for the next day if you let them even pupate. It was brought up to our attention that, you know, maybe what's going on is that when you put the ammonia here, it's not really smell. Maybe it's diffusing from the filter and they're tasting it. So we decided to do like a dye assay, and it looks like there's some diffusion, a lot. But the point was well taken that it might be taste and not smell. So just to be sure, we switched the protocol slightly to sort of these modified petri plates, where we put a moistened piece of filter paper, we release them in the middle here, and instead of just having the filter papers here and here, we kind of modify these falcon tubes so there's a pit. So that, you know, when they fall into the pit, they're not tasting it, obviously. They're falling in, you know, because they're smelling something. So when we did that, we continued on with our full list that we had. And essentially, to cut to the chase, we found still ammonia is highly, highly attractive. So this is starting with the concentrate, full concentrate, and then working up to the dilution. I mean, this is kind of shocking that they're attracted to ammonia at that high of a concentration. And then we found that the esters were really attractive. A lot of the esters. Not as attractive as ammonia, but they're attracted to esters. Pretty much, and I'm glad that we did the ammonia first, because this is most of what we found. When you compare it to the baseline, there's really no response at all, and it was a great experience for the grad student working on this. And, you know, in terms of research, this is most of what we do. He just, you know, happened to get lucky with the first one. Okay, so the take-home message here is that it's ammonia and esters, and the next question is why. Well, we think ammonia might be a signal, or might be a VOC coming from some sort of functional microbial group, but what about the esters? You know, that might be too, but you know, you look into the literature, and esters are a common volatile from the green leaf volatiles. Isn't that right? Someone here who works with plants. And that's interesting, because here in the United States, when we talk about larval development, we normally talk about substrate with decomposing vegetation, something that's been there a while and is rotting. But we're starting to get a story from other places, such as Costa Rica and Australia, that that's not true. And Dave is going to talk about this if he hasn't already. In Costa Rica, they have a really interesting scenario wherein as soon as they cut the pineapple plant for crop, the gravid stable flies are there immediately to oviposit in the stalks of that plant. So what's going on? So is there a relationship then between like fresh vegetation and larval development? And even if that's true, why would a stable fly larvae be responding to that? I don't know, but it's a possibility. And it comes back to looking at the larval morphology, right? And this idea in that, you know, we're focusing primarily on the role of microorganisms in larval nutrition, but there's a very real possibility, right, a lot like the pseudotracheae of adult houseflies, that they're secreting saliva to ingest something extra that's been extra orally digested, plant material maybe, right? Okay, so do I have like 1 minute left? Okay, so tying this all back into the microbial community, again, we found that the stable fly larvae have gut communities that are distinct from those of the substrate in which they were found, and the summary of that's kind of listed there. The 16F communities of the larvae are more similar to each other than to the substrate on which they were fed. So I don't think that's a surprise to anyone here, but it's still interesting to know that. There were no observable differences between the natural substrate with and without larvae, which again, we were kind of hoping to see, but we just might need to go in and do some more intensive sampling to find that. And, you know, this is interesting, that there is a diverse set of fungi associated with larvae and the substrates, and this is something that I think that we're going to pursue a little more heavily in our lab. And then, of course, non-target 18S assignments to the Aviolata supports our microscopic work, which is always good to know. So, that's it. Kind of a rush whirlwind.